From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we honor fathers and sons with some funny, some moving, and some strange stories. Tenor sax player Ellery Eskelin tells us about his musician father's untimely demise and his enduring inspiration. Then Daddy's Boy, a son's shocking account of life with a famous father. Comedians Chris and Bob Elliott collaborated on a satirical look at Chris's childhood. Also, writer André Debus III talks about the death of his father. And Ben Cheever tells us about discovering secrets in the letters of his late father, John Cheever. Later, jazz singer and guitarist John Pizzarelli talks about his musical relationship with his dad, Bucky Pizzarelli. They're still performing together. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli helicopters have launched more missile attacks in the Gaza Strip. An Israeli military source described the latest target as a weapons storage site, but Palestinian witnesses say the target was the home of a Hamas member. Earlier, a Hamas member was killed and at least 32 other people were reported injured in another Israeli helicopter attack on a car in Gaza City. The BBC's Johnny Diamond reports from Jerusalem.
The rocket attack on the car carrying the Hamas member was the sixth attack against Palestinian targets by the Israeli armed forces this week. Three rockets were fired at a car containing what the Israeli Defense Force said was a Hamas cell preparing a rocket attack on Israel. One man has been confirmed killed, Fuad al-Ladawi, a member of Hamas's military wing. About 2 hours after the attack, helicopter gunships again fired on Gaza City, targeting what Israeli military sources described as a weaponry warehouse.
The BBC's Johnny Diamond. American soldiers in Iraq fought an overnight battle with gunmen loyal to Saddam Hussein. And the commander of U.S. ground forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General David McKiernan, said the action started when insurgents tried to ambush a U.S. tank patrol about 30 miles northwest of Baghdad.
As recently as last night, we had actions against part of our forces in that area, and the battalion that was engaged pursued those forces, made contact with them, and killed over 20 of them.
U.S. officials said there were no American casualties. The fight came as the U.S. military continues a sweeping operation to hunt down Saddam loyalists. The U.S. Senate has plenty of millionaires who can benefit from the recent tax cuts. Senators' financial disclosure statements for last year were made public today. NPR's Peter Overby reports from the Capitol.
The Senate has always been a chamber of wealth. This time it's news that West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd, the longest-serving senator, doesn't have any big investments. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist reported blind trusts totaling somewhere between $6.5 and $31 million. Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy's net worth could run as high as $50 million. The reports are vague because federal disclosure forms ask for ranges of value, not exact dollar amounts. More specifically, Hillary Rodham Clinton reported getting more than $1 million of the advance for her new book. She also reported that her husband, the former president, takes some speaking engagements that pay better than her $150,000 a year senatorial salary. Disclosure reports for House members come out on Monday. Peter Overby, NPR News, The Capitol.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 79 points to close at 9,117 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 27 to close at 1,626. This is NPR News. In Iran today, religious militants and state security forces attacked people on the streets of Tehran as the country's Islamic rulers sought to crack down on anti-government protesters. The militants and police used tear gas to disperse crowds, fired guns in the air, and beat bystanders, although witnesses say there were only small groups of protesters in the capital. The apparent crackdown came after 4 nights of protest in which demonstrators called for the ouster of the country's clerical government. Federal prosecutors in Detroit are dropping obstruction of justice charges against pro basketball player Chris Webber. The former University of Michigan star must still stand trial for perjury. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET.
The charges stem from a federal investigation into alleged payments made to Webber and other athletes while they were still university students, a violation of collegiate rules. Michigan sports booster Ed Martin pleaded guilty last year to using proceeds from an illegal gambling lottery to loan Weber and other student-athletes hundreds of thousands of dollars. Martin died in February, and Weber has consistently denied the allegations. Weber, his father, and an aunt were indicted for allegedly lying to a grand jury about the payments. The charges against Weber's aunt were later dropped, but Weber and his father still face trial in July. They're accused of perjuring themselves before the grand jury. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Wholesale prices fell in May largely because of a drop in energy costs. The Labor Department said its producer price index fell 0.3%. It was the second straight monthly decline in wholesale prices. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Legacy Foundation, dedicated to building a world where young people reject tobacco and anyone can quit. www.americanlegacy.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're celebrating Father's Day by featuring sons talking about their fathers. One of those sons is saxophonist and composer Branford Marsalis.
You grew up in what is now America's probably most famous jazz family, the Marsalis family. Your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist. When you were growing up liking the pop music that you liked, did you feel about his music the way, say, I felt about my father's old Benny Goodman records?
I felt about my father's music the way that my next-door neighbor felt about his father, the chauffeur driver. That was just what he did.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about your father's
Benny Goodman records? Oh, yeah, I guess I didn't. I really disliked them until I got much older. Well, in my 20s, anyways.
Jazz is not for kids. I know there's an argument. My brother says jazz can be for kids. I don't think... Jazz has a level of sophistication that's just way too hip for kids. It's not a music for kids, and it certainly wasn't a music for me. But it wasn't like he'd play them and I'd go, arr! I would just leave the room.
He just didn't care.
And turn on the television in the other room until it was my turn to listen to my music. And then I'd put on Cheech and Chong and Elton John and James Brown and whatever I wanted to put on. And my father would stay out. And then when James Brown came on, he'd come in and say, yeah, kid, yeah, Jack, I like that. And then he would always dance to it. When he danced to it, he would snap his fingers on 2 and 4, which was the funniest thing in the world. You know,
that's great.
You know, cold sweats going on. You know, like a cold sweat. Dun dun dun. Do ba da do do dee da. My father's going, yeah. Da 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 do dee da. I'm like, no, Dad. It's just funny.
It's on the one.
Oh yeah, it was classic.
Oh, that's great.
Bradford Marsalis talking to Terry last year. Comic Chris Elliott is the son of Bob Elliott, half of the comedy team Bob and Ray. Chris has been a cast member of Saturday Night Live and is a former writer for The David Letterman Show. When Terry talked with Chris and Bob Elliott in 1989, Chris had just published a Mommy Dearest parody about how horrible his childhood was. It's called Daddy's Boy, a son's shocking account of life with his famous father. Chris read an excerpt called Birthday Hell about a birthday party his father orchestrated for him in which Chris was allowed to invite one of his classmates.
I was always a very shy little boy. I was scared of clowns, and I retreated violently from anything that smacked of audience participation. At a party, if a magician pulled me out of a group as his volunteer assistant, my body would immediately stiffen like a plank of wood, and my scalp would foam up with hot sweat. Anything like a sing-along would elicit the same reaction. I remember needing oxygen at Macy's after meeting Santa Claus, and once I told Ronald McDonald that I wished he was dead. So all in all, I was not a party boy, and no one knew this better than Daddy. Still, my 6th birthday was to be bigger and better than any before. Daddy filled our backyard with every conceivable form of audience participation known to man. Are you enjoying this so far, Dad?
Have you begun it?
There were clowns, mimes, jugglers, puppet shows, magicians, dancers, all eager to involve me in their acts. There were fashion shows, wrestling matches, and Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, gave a cooking demonstration. It was everything that I hated. I was allowed to invite only 2 of my classmates. The rest of the invitations went out to Daddy's friends. Among those who attended were Dick Cavett, Al Hirschfeld, and Jerry Vale. Not the most exciting group of playmates for a 6-year-old kid. Dick Cavett bent my ear for an hour and a half about peanut butter. But for my dad, the party was a big success. As usual, the press was invited, the television networks set up their anchor booths around the yard, and the Happy Elliott Clan public relations machine shifted into high gear. Music filled the backyard. It was Steve Allen hogging the grand piano. Charles Kuralt wrestled Andy Rooney shirtless, and Art Buchwald rode the giant trained pig. At lunch, the big table was set, and I sat at the head of it, and we ate bean and bacon soup and filet mignon, blood rare, as usual. And the photographers snapped their shots of the privileged life of which the world was so envious.
Now, Chris Elliott, what are some of the books that you read to get in the spirit for this malicious tell-all book?
Well, sort of
unfortunately. I'm sure I've interviewed every one of the authors, by the way.
Probably. Well, I guess I went back to see if there were any books like this, and I found that there were quite a few. I guess Christina Crawford's Mommy Dearest was sort of a template for some of the stuff, and of course Gary Crosby's work about it, his dad, and B.D. Hyman's book. There's a little of that in this also. I must say, though, my dad's ignoring my chapters. I find that incredibly bumptious on his part.
Well, Bob Elliott, were you ever afraid that people would read this book and not get the joke and think that you were the kind of father as is described in the book? And,
no.
And that you forced Chris to dress like you and put on a bald wig?
Well, I don't know what that means. But
that's in chapter three, Dad.
Oh.
You really haven't read the book.
No. I was never concerned because I thought I made my points perfectly clear. It was a chance to set down some ideas and thoughts I've had over the years and had no place to go with, and this seemed a real good spot.
Chris Elliott, when you were growing up, how aware of you were you of your father's comedy? Did you hear radio shows? The TV show was already over.
Yeah, the TV show was over, and I heard him on the radio. I was aware he was funny, but I assumed everybody else's dad was, too, and it never really occurred to me that no one else's dad had a radio show. He'd leave in the morning wearing a suit and a tie and carrying a briefcase. I'd hear his voice on the radio, and then he'd come back in the afternoon, but I never quite made the connection that he was a performer. I guess when I was about 10 and they had a Broadway show, I started to realize that he makes people laugh for a living and that maybe I could try to rip off the public that way also.
Did he do characters around the house?
No. It was a very normal, dull, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Good word.
Childhood. There weren't, it wasn't like, a wacky, off-the-wall comedic lifestyle that we led. It was very dry-witted.
I think that really was the secret of Bob and Ray not being wacky or off the wall, although some of the material came off that way, but we were very kind of introspective and shy in a certain extent, and when we began radio, we were amusing ourselves.
How did the process of writing this book together change your relationship at all?
No, I don't think it changed relationship any, really. We maintained a remote relationship while we were writing it, and we're leaving separately from here.
Yeah, it's the book tour that's changing it. We're really...
Just being together is really terrible.
We're kind of just sick of each other, and it's just begun.
Chris and Bob Elliott talking with Terry in 1989. Jazz saxophonist and composer Ellery Eskelin never knew his father. His parents divorced shortly after he was born, and his father died in a mysterious accident, or suicide, when he was a child. His father, Rod Keith, was a musician as well, with an unusual day job. Terry spoke with Eskelin in 1996. She asked him to describe the music his father was known for.
It's called song poem music, and I consider it a genre unto itself. It's the result of those ads that people have probably seen in the backs of magazines, in which companies solicit the public to send in their lyrics. Their lyrics then get the full studio treatment by Hollywood's finest, set to music and recorded, and with that you're on your way to fame and stardom.
So the idea is you write a poem, you write a lyric, you mail it in, and for a fee, the composers who work for this company will set it to music and give
exactly.
you a studio recording of it.
Exactly.
And then do they make you any promises about what's going to happen to that recording? Do they promise you're going to become a famous songwriter or a star? Or it'll...
Well, that's the inference.
Mm-hmm.
As far as promises, I don't think the promises went much farther than the fact that the records might be sent around or even played on radio stations. Whether those promises were honored in every case, that's open to conjecture. So song poems, that's what the polite way of putting it. The people who were in the industry called it song sharking.
Why did they call it that?
Well, I guess because it's something just short of being a scam in a way. You're sort of preying on people's instincts for, fame or notoriety. I can't really defend the practice much more than to say that there were a lot of clients who I think were just simply thrilled to have their music on a disc and have their name on a record, because in fact there were many repeat clients. It was all, sort of a vanity thing for many people as to whether they thought they were going to get famous. If they did think that, it was unfortunate, and that's where the possible scam comes in.
So your father would crank out up to 30 melodies a day for these lyrics.
Yeah, he was a very gifted musician, and he was able to do this kind of work very easily. It was sort of his, I guess you might call it a day job, in as much it was his means to make a living while he pursued, I'm not quite sure what else he pursued, but this is what we have left.
Why don't we hear the title track of the new record that you've produced, mm-hmm. of the songs that your father did while working for one of these companies, actually while working for several of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
And the title track is called I Died Today. And we'll hear your father, Rod Keith, singing and at the keyboard.
It was a dark and a rainy night. My headlights weren't really too bright. I was thinking of my kids and of my darling wife. My sales were down, my pay was small, and I needed money bad. I couldn't pay the mortgage to even keep the things we had. Then through the night there came a light. A hobo wanted a ride. I brought my old car to a stop, and he got in by my side. We continued on, just we two. His presence seemed to calm my nerves, but the road was wet and my vision blurred. And I didn't see the curve. When I awoke, I saw the flames and the people through the trees. I knew from their conversation, they thought the hobo was me.
That's I Died Today, the title track from a compilation of Rod Keith's recordings, produced by his son, Ellery Eskelin. We'll continue Terry's 1996 conversation with Eskelin after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're celebrating Father's Day on Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Ellery Eskelin, son of composer for hire, Rod Keith.
Now, your father was sent lyrics that were supposed to fit into every genre. So he had to write songs around every genre, dance crazes, novelties, romantic ballads, patriotic anthems.
Right.
Let's hear one of the kind of hippie dance tunes that he did. This is something called Hippie Happy Land.
Right.
And again, he's singing, and I guess on keyboards. Anything mm-hmm. that you know about this song or any feelings that you have about it?
Again, just that I'm just, as is the case with most of these songs, they're just sort of just what they are. But I think Rod really brings to each one a surprising little twist, or just a little bit more than you might expect from these proceedings, if you will. When you listen to the words, sometimes they can be funny or even a little inane, but he really brings himself to it with a lot of vigor and 100% of himself, even if it might be a little tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, that's certainly the case with this one.
Let's hear it. This is Hippie Happy Land.
Hop and skip and twirl your girl. We're living in a happy, hippie, happy world. We're a hippie, happy family. Now shake those hips for me. Now hop and skip and twist your girl. We're living in a hippie, happy world. What are those hippies asking me? The funny looking folks you see, who with their heavy thick beards and the
You never really knew your father. Your parents separated when you were very young.
Yeah.
And your father stayed in Los Angeles. You and your parents moved to Baltimore, I believe?
Mm-hmm. That's where my mother is originally from.
So, the only information you have about your father is what relatives have told you and what you've heard mm-hmm. from these records. Have these records changed your idea of who your father was?
I guess they haven't changed it so much. I think they represent an accurate, if only partial, picture of who he was. When I was growing up, I was told many, many stories of my father's talent and idiosyncrasies. He was described as being quite the charming eccentric. And as I became serious about music myself and began playing saxophone at age 10, these stories really started to have a profound effect on me. Unfortunately, Rod died in 1974, very tragically, and before I ever had a chance to really make his acquaintance or communicate with him in much of any way, it was over. So I've had these stories as part of my life now. I'm 37, and this music has recently come to my attention only in the last maybe 2 years. I was aware that Rod did this kind of stuff, and I had even heard a few examples when I was a teenager, and at the time I wasn't that impressed because it just didn't seem to sort of coincide with the sort of genius that everyone had been talking about. But now that I've heard so many of them and I can put them in a context of just exactly what the nature of the business was, and just imagine what it must have taken to be able to accomplish the task, I'm actually quite impressed. He has had to have been quite an imaginative guy, I think, to be able to do as many of these things off the top of his head is the way I'm told that he could do them. It was just almost effortless.
Well, as I said before, he wrote in all kinds of genres, novelty dance tunes like mm-hmm. Do the Pig and Do the Turkey, and,
right.
and romantic ballads. There's even a patriotic number, a patriotic anthem mm-hmm. that you have on the new record called I Am a Real American. Mm-hmm. And for listeners just joining us, again, my guest is Ellery Eskelin, and he's a jazz musician. His father, who died in 1974, specialized in setting other people's lyrics to music. And he basically worked at a house where this is what they did. They advertised in the backs of magazines and asked people to send in their poems and lyrics, and they tell you professional musicians would set it to music and mail the results back to you. So here's one of the results. This is a lyric that was mailed to your father. I am a real American, and we'll hear your father doing the voice on this.
First of all, allow me to make myself perfectly clear. Dear Lord, help us to love each other instead of
I believe in the Constitution of the USA. I respect the Holy Bible, every word it says. I believe in human rights, regardless of color. And I will not allow myself to mislead others.
My utmost aim in life is to love and respect my wife. My family, neighbors, love them all as one, for this God gave his only son. I believe utmost in integrity and unity. Educational equality with divine obligation.
Are these records the only times that you've heard your father's voice?
Yes, they are. They are. I was just trying to think if there were any other. No, there. This is exactly it, and so. That's been pretty interesting because along with the stylistic compass that Rod used, which is pretty wide, he was very agile with his voice. And so on a country tune, he's got a certain sound, and on a rock tune, he's got a slightly different sound. And he was a little bit chameleonic with it. There's very few instances of his speaking voice that I've found yet, with the exception of some old studio tapes where he's introducing or slating the song in between the vocal. And there might be a little bit of joking around or asides or something like that, which are pretty interesting. He had quite a knack, I understand, for linguistics in general. And he would do things with the play on words and even make up his own words and talk backwards and everything else. So that's pretty intriguing question, actually. That's something I've thought about a lot.
Terry spoke with saxophonist Ellery Eskelin in 1996. Eskelin produced a collection of his father's songs. It's called I Died Today. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Ellery Eskelin playing Twist in the Jug, recorded in 1996.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost in Translation, a novel about an American woman experiencing Beijing for the first time by Nicole Moniz. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, talented sons of talented fathers. Writers André Debuse III and Ben Cheever remember the lives and loves of their late dads. And John Pizzarelli talks about his musical family. His father is jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our Father's Day show with this excerpt from a 1999 interview Terry recorded with André Debus III. He's been described as a remarkable and distinctive writer, who is the son of a remarkable and distinctive writer. As you may know, Debus's father, André Debus Sr., lost one leg and lost all use of the other in a freak car accident in 1986. Terry spoke with Debus shortly after his father died.
I was very sorry to hear about the death of your father recently. Had he been sick, or was this just an out-of-the-blue thing?
No, it was just one of those terrible sudden deaths. He, you know, as you know, because you've interviewed him over the years, he was in a wheelchair the last 12 and a half years of his life, and that's not easy on anybody. But, you know, that notwithstanding, he was in pretty good physical shape. You know, my brother and his partner had built a really long, straight ramp from his house just in the last few months, and my father did sprints on it in his wheelchair. In the summer, he swam laps in his pool. He shadow boxed and lifted weights. I mean, he took relatively good care of himself. So, you know, he was 62, and we didn't know. It was a shock. He got in the shower and had a heart attack and died.
Now, I understand that in his papers, he'd asked that you build his coffin, and you're one of the many things you do is you're a carpenter.
Mm.
What was your reaction when you found that out?
Well, it was not in his will at all. It actually came as my brother and I were busting his chops over, frankly, the last story he'd ever written called Sisters. It's a Western, and in the Western, the hero builds a coffin for a man and digs the grave and does it all in about 3.5 hours. And my father was a master writer, but he'd never worked with his hands. And my brother and I have always done this kind of work. And we really gave him grief for that, because there ain't no way you can build a box that can hold a 200-pound man in 3 hours, let alone with hand tools, and then dig a hole around trees with roots. So we really gave him, you know, a lot of heat for that, and we're having fun doing it out on his deck this past summer. And he said, well, when you build my coffin, you can take all the time you want, and I want it to be straight pine. And then we got into the discussion here, and he said, and I want to be buried on my land. And so that was just you know, this past summer, and from busting his chops. And so I was on this book tour for this novel when I heard in San Francisco, and all I wanted to do was get back and hug my children and then go find my brother and build the coffin. And we did. We gathered the lumber store, my brother Jeb and me, and we designed it, you know, through tears. And it was weird, just such a stark experience. And then bought the wood, spent about an hour picking it out in the lumber yard where we've been for years on jobs. Went to his shop, and from about 5 at night to 9 in the morning, we built my dad's coffin out of pine. And it was a beautiful night, though, I have to say. You know, it'd be like on a job. You know, we'd say, come on, what kind of a router is that? What kind of a dado is that? Give me your router, let me show you how to do it. And then there, you know, it'd be this, you know, masculine sparring. And then we'd be hugging each other and crying. And then we'd be ripping a piece of wood on the table saw and laughing and crying. And then there'd be these long moments of stillness and quiet. Over the course of the night, his friends would come by. You know, his longtime agent and friend, Philip Spitzer, and his brother, Michelle, came with their some family, and they just came and were there and took some pieces of wood with them when they left. And one of my father's priests came by about 3 in the morning and helped us sand. And then some friends came at dawn with beer and sandwiches. We took a break. And when it was finally done, I lay in the coffin and had him shut it so I could feel what it was like. And I was also honestly testing to see if the lid was the right height and there was enough curve to it. And then we dug the grave because we ended up buying a plot of land 1/2 mile from my dad's house, and the farmer who we bought it from said that she hired her hands to dig it by shovel. She didn't have a backhoe. And when we heard that, we said, well, no, we'll be happy to dig it. If anybody's going to be digging this grave by hand, it'll be his sons. And so my brother Jeb and I and our good friend Bill Cantwell, who's like a third son to my father, we dug the grave. And the funny thing is it took 8 hours. So building the coffin with power tools took 2 men about 12 hours, and digging the grave with 3 men took 8 hours. So the veracity of that detail was off in that story.
So you were right to criticize your father.
Yeah, you need to redo that one.
did he, by the way, redo it?
No, he didn't. He said, no, well, then there was sand near those roots, and he happened to have the tools. You know, he exercised, you know, he was so far along in the craft. He was such a master. He said, hey, screw it. This is called poetic license. I don't know if he said that, but that's essentially what he did. He just put down the big staff and said, poetic license, move on.
As many of our listeners know, your father lost his legs in a road accident back in 1986. He was helping people who had been hit by a car when he was hit by another oncoming car. I'm wondering how the accident affected your relationship with him.
Well, I think, you know, I'm the second oldest of his six children. I have an older sister, Suzanne, and then me, and then my brother, Jeb, my sister, Nicole, and then my two sisters, Cadence and Madeline, from my father's third marriage. And I think I can speak for all of them, because we've all talked about this, when I say that we all got closer. It's very hard to see anyone in your family suffer, and so that was hard, but not any hard. It was a lot harder for him. So I think the short answer, and I think hopefully the most honest answer, is we got closer in those 13 years, mainly because he was very focused on family in that last decade. Family and writing, I think, for a number of reasons. One, his writing had gotten to the point where he was making a living from it and didn't have to have another job. And he was raising his two young daughters who were still just 16 and 12. And no, that's not completely true. What happened, though, I think, and my father's written about this and talked about it, is something spiritual. He shifted into a higher spiritual gear, which I don't think just anybody would do, suffering a crippling. And consequently, he was a very present, focused father. And I'm just so grateful for all the times we've had in these last almost 13 years. I mean, he really should have been killed in 1986. He was run over at 58 miles an hour. He was standing on the road, got hit at 58 miles an hour. There's a quarter bent in half in his front pocket. So I personally just feel so grateful he was around another 12 and a half years. I want him around another 20. I am not ready for him to be gone, and I miss him terribly. We had some really, really wonderful talks and family times in the last 12 and a half years.
When your father was alive, did you show each other your writing before it was published?
Yes, we did. Absolutely.
And were you honest with each other? You know, it's hard sometimes when you're really close to someone and they give you their work. If there's mm-hmm. something that you don't think works, it could be hard to be honest. Cause,
yeah, you know, it really is hard to be honest. Well, you know, honestly, there is very little my father gave me of his that I could say anything but, wow, Dad.
Right.
Pretty great. Can I go hide now and curl up in a ball somewhere? You know, I mean, they're honestly, out of the 80, 90, I have to count now how many stories he wrote and published. I think it's close to 100 in his lifetime, in his career. There was one little story I didn't like, and I told him right off. And he wrote it on the plane on the way down to a reading, and it read like it to me, and it got up into one of his books, and I said, Dad, that one just doesn't work for me. And but he always told me as well, but after a while I didn't trust him, because he was so effusive about my work. He believed in it so much more than I ever believed in my own, and I thought, oh, and also when I became a father, you know, come on, I want to show people my son's poop. look how cute that little spit is at the corner of his lip. When I became a father, I really stopped believing him. Although it's probably unfair to him, but I thought, come on, he loves me. He's not going to tell me this is a contrived piece of crap I have to write over. You know, but we did. We showed each other after. Over the years, I've been defensive because people have assumed with the same name and having my father as a writer that, you know, he helped me. Well, no, he didn't. He helped me afterwards. If I had a draft done, I'd show it to him and show it to my wife and a couple of friends of mine whose opinion I respected, but my agent. But it was always after the fact. And more so for me, just I've always been a fairly private, independent little guy. And, you know, a Virgo. So, you know, I never showed him until I was done.
André Debuse III, talking with Terry in 1999. His books include The House of Sand and Fog and The Cage Keeper. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ There are parts of most parents' lives that are hidden from their children. In 1988, Ben Cheever wanted to learn more about his father, the late Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and short story writer John Cheever. So Ben edited a book of his father's letters. The collection includes John Cheever's letters to and about such literary figures as John Updike, Robert Penn Warren, Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. There are also some very personal letters written to his wife and to the women and men who were his lovers. For Ben, the most difficult revelation was the extent of his father's homosexuality. Terry spoke with Ben Cheever after the publication of the collection. She asked him to read a letter his father had written to a male lover.
Dear blank, comma, I'm truly sorry to hear about your father, and I'm much too old to have anything fresh or useful to say. I felt that I must strike some peace with my own father, although we both tried to kill one another. I made him into Leander and struck a useful peace after his death. I think you must do something of the sort. You must try to understand the man. I've told my own sons that when they find me lacking, they can continue to love me and find other men who will wear underwear, pitch no-hitters, and invent the telephone. It seems to work. I think I've known no man who has not accomplished this.
Did he, by the way, directly or indirectly, make that clear to you that when you found him lacking, to continue to love him and look for the traits that you were missing in other men?
Well, he did say that he had had many fathers and that I should try and have many fathers, too. Interestingly enough, my relationship with him was sufficiently intense that I rarely had an older mentor, and I'm only beginning to make good friends with older men now that he's gone.
Were you afraid when you were going through the letters that your father wrote that you'd find information about how he felt about you, information that might surprise or disturb you? And did anything like that happen?
Well, I was afraid. It wasn't as clear as that. But yes, I think I was afraid that I would have to come to grips with things that would make me uncomfortable, and certainly I did. Part of the good news of my father's life is that he loved a lot of people. He loved a lot of people passionately. He loved a number of women, and he loved a number of men. This is good news, because he was also lonely sometimes, and I'm pleased to know that he loved all these people. At the same time, I'm not so big that I'm not a little jealous and a little hurt by the letters that he wrote to young men he loved. He was often very loving to me, but he was very passionately in love with some of these guys.
You know, in trying to think about, because I know that you say that the most disturbing revelation about the letters for you was the extent of his homosexuality, and it never occurred to me, but I see that now, that one of the things that would have disturbed you was a sense of jealousy that he had lovers who were probably around your age.
Well, that's right, and it's odd. I certainly wouldn't have wanted him to consummate his relationship with me in the way that he consummated his relationship with some of these other men. At the same time, it raises serious questions. I've been told by some of the men he was in love with that he would talk about me sometimes as someone who was physically attractive to him. I was completely unaware of this when it was going on because he was very stern in his public denial of bisexuality throughout most of his life. But it raises some interesting I wonder, because a lot of the time, the way he was, when he was angry at me, some of the time he was angry at me because I was a pest. I think all children are, having children of my own. But some of the time he was angry at me because he loved me. And I was just reading his journals, and there's an incident in which I went to pick blueberries. I guess I was 11 years old. And I don't even remember the friend I went to pick blueberries with. It wasn't someone I particularly liked. And I come back from picking blueberries, and he's sore at me because I haven't picked a lot of blueberries. Well, I didn't know why he was angry at me. Well, it turns out he was angry at me because he thought I was off in the woods with this other kid doing something unspeakable. Well, I wasn't, you know. I don't know what we did. We just didn't find a lot of blueberries. So that's very confusing for me. When I play back my life, where was he, you know, what was love and what was hate? What was genuine disappointment, and what was his projection of his own problems on me. It's hard to figure out. I'm sure it's hard for any son to figure out.
Were you jealous that attention he was paying to other lovers was attention that he could have been paying to members of his family?
Well, one of his lovers, who I talked with, and some of them, a couple of them have been very friendly and are friends, said that to me. He said, I felt that I was taking love from your father that maybe you or your sister or your mother could have had. And I really feel, and I say in the introduction, that you have to take the people you love pretty much the way you find them. You can't say, gee, he would have been wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never had a drink. Wouldn't have been wonderful if he'd never loved another man or another woman. Well, he wouldn't have been himself. And love it's not like marbles. You have three of them and you give one to you give one to someone and then you don't have one to give to someone else. It's a mysterious thing, and I think probably his love, the love that he had from these people enriched his life, and the joy he got from it probably enriched mine. But I don't mean to say that, having come to this understanding, that I'm not capable of petty jealousies, and because I am. But I think when you really examine it, as I had to, you realize that any dramatic change in him would have also changed the man I loved in ways that might not have been fortunate.
We're listening to a 1988 interview with Ben Cheever, recorded after he edited a collection of letters by his father, the late writer John Cheever. Ben wrote the introduction to the book. Here's a short reading.
The introduction is titled The Man I Thought I Knew, and it begins, when my father stopped breathing, I tried to start his lungs again by blowing air through his lips. Then I put my arms around him. My mother and sister joined in the embrace. I could hear my sister and my mother crying, and then I could hear myself. We were standing at the end of the bed when the man from the funeral home arrived. All three faces were wet with tears. My father was naked except for a fresh white cast on one leg. He had taken a bad fall earlier in the week. His skin was pale and luminous like parchment, and I remember thinking that it looked as if it still had many years of wear in it.
I was wondering if it was very hard for you to write that, in the sense that I think when you're the son of a famous writer, that it's easy to feel in the shadow of your father, at least for a while, and to wonder, what would they think if they read this? And here you were actually describing the moment of his death. Was that hard to do?
Well, interestingly enough, this book wasn't hard in that way, because he wasn't here to write it, you know. If he'd been here to write his description, that would have been fine, and I wouldn't have tried. And I tried because he wasn't here. And I mean, the part I like best in the introduction is a little bit later on in the first page. The undertaker comes, and the undertaker is as I guess they usually are, he's rough with the body, you know, with his sacred body. And as he got ready to put it in his station wagon, I said, be careful with him or he'll bite you. And he turned to me and said, don't worry about me, I handled Rockefeller. And I said, but Rockefeller was dead. And I really felt, in working on this book, and I still feel very strongly, that my father is not dead in the sense that I had always understood death before that afternoon. It may be that nobody dies in the way that, I know I sound like a crank spiritualist, but it may be. I don't burn candles, and I don't. But there were periods of time in my life when I didn't get along with him. There was a period of about 7 years when we only spoke in curt telegraphic sentences, and in many ways he was gone from me more then than he is now. It's changed for him. That's the hard part. It hasn't changed for me as much as it's changed for him. He can't write anymore. If he was alive, we'd be finding manuscripts somewhere. But I do think, you know, I run a lot, and I'll come around a bend in a park, and I really, honestly will expect to see him there.
Ben Cheever from a 1988 interview. We'll hear another father-son story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our Father's Day celebration. In 1997, Terry spoke with jazz singer and guitarist John Pizzarelli.
I'm fortunate enough that I think, you know, to have grown up with, I think, probably one of the best rhythm guitar players in the world.
With you. your father, Bucky Pizzarelli.
When you hear that around the house, and then, you know, when you make a mistake at your, you know, he always called it a stroke. He said, you know, it's the way your right hand strikes the string. So even though you're playing the blues with the chords F and B flat, those chords, he would always want to hear just one note. Because that's the only note, that's the right note that's got to speak through the band. And you always hear that on my records because my dad's the guy playing it. And it's, you don't have to hit all the notes in the chord. You just had to hit that one. It's like more, it's almost like a musical rhythm instrument. Like it's like a drum almost. Like with my trio, since there's no drums, that it covers that. You can hear boom, 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 doom, 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 doom. And that's so, and you have that. It's like a hi-hat almost.
That's great. Did your father, Bucky Pizzarelli, teach you at all? And did you want to learn from him or not? It's, I think, can be very hard to learn from a family member anything.
We had one guitar lesson, and he kept hitting me on my knuckles with his pencil. So that I kept saying, like, and he'd laugh, you know. I said, no more of that. And then basically when he heard the band or if he heard me practice or something, I had a buddy of mine who played jazz guitar, studied with Barry Galbraith, and we would play duets, and he'd come in once in a while and say, you know, instead of just going, cigarette holder, da 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 da, and I was always playing the chords, and he'd say, why don't you go, da 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 da. He'd show me these little variations, and then all of a sudden I was going, well, that's how that worked. Well, I could do that here on another song, you know, and start to see how it all worked out as an accompanist. And I learned how to be an accompanist first, and then started in 1980 working with my father. And we worked, it's either 80 or 81 at the Pierre Hotel for 8 weeks. And I always say I knew 4 songs on the first day and about 400 on the last day. Learning them was the hardest part.
John, what did you learn about the jazz life from watching your father's life?
Well, I think what was great about my dad, and still is that he enjoyed I think he just loves playing the guitar and being around great musicians. And I think he had a respect for all the guys he played for. And therefore, his circle of friends was an interesting one. Zoot Sims, a tenor saxophone player, who was a fun-loving, great saxophone player, but a fun-loving guy, a great drinker and a great hangout guy. And my father, fairly straight-ahead guy, not much of a drinker, but loved to play. And Zoot, I think, loved playing with him because they liked to play so much together. And they got along afterwards because my father, they loved to cajole each other. And I'm sort of the same way in a sense that I like playing with musicians. Yeah, and I also love the fun part afterwards, just talking about stuff and having fun. And I think I saw a lot of that growing up and try to take that with me.
Now, I know when you were growing up in New Jersey that Richard Nixon was a neighbor part of the time. Did you get to find out anything about his musical taste?
He never played piano for me. I know he was a big piano player, but I did play for him once. He used to hang out in Hohokus, which was 2 towns over from Saddle River, and he had his shoes done by certain. There was a certain group of old stores that the shoemaker, barber kind of, you know, town stores. And he always went to the same place for his haircut, and they all got to like him. And it was Pat's 65th birthday, and he said, "I'd like to do something special for her." And they said, "Well, Bucky comes in here and gets his shoes done all the time, so why don't you have his son and they could play for her, you know, come over and play?" He said, "Well, I'm having a little get together. We'll surprise her." So my dad and I, we were going to another gig, but we had time. And we went over and we set up in the foyer. And Pat came out of a door, and there were these 2 guitar players. And then all of a sudden, Nixon and his daughter came in the door with the kids, and then Bebe Rebozo and his wife were there. It was a wild little birthday party, and it was a big surprise. And he liked the music. Actually, the one thing I did learn that Bebe Rebozo's favorite song was Penthouse Serenade. So there you go. These are the things. You don't get this information anywhere else.
John Pizzarelli spoke with Terry Gross in 1997. John and Bucky Pizzarelli have recorded a number of CDs together on the Arbors label, and they're still doing dates together. This weekend, Bucky Pizzarelli appears with John and his other son, bass player Martin Pizzarelli, at Feinstein's at the Regency in New York City. ¶¶ Well, that's almost it for our Father's Day show, but we have one more son to check in with.
Were there any jokers in your family? Did you have a father who'd sit around the dinner table and tell jokes?
Yeah, he used to goof off, and he used to make prank phone calls, and I mean, the look for annoying man I got from him, he used to comb his hair forward and wear his glasses low. He didn't act like that, but that's where I got the look from, and he used to do something. He used to come home and tell us he was his twin brother, Howard. We would be like 7 or 8, and but he would play it so straight for like a half an hour and just insist on it, and then he would leave, and then like 20 minutes later come back. I guess he would just wait in his car. And then we'd say, Howard was here. He goes, he was? You know.
So he really had a twin brother, Howard?
Huh? No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't?
No, he just said he did.
I see. Okay.
We were young. He would do stuff like that.
John Lovett speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Happy Father's Day.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comedian Colin Quinn tells us about taking over the anchor spot on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update just as the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal heated up. And he'll talk about his new show, Tough Crowd, with Colin Quinn. Join us for the next Fresh Air.